I'm Jordan. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Jordan.
Oh, I was hoping, I was like sitting here going, okay, let's end the table. Maybe I'll be last. Apparently not. apparently not. This subject's very dear to me, and today I feel even a little bit more pressure and a little bit more cathartic because I just buried a 21-year-old girl today due to this disease. Left a 3-year-old baby, and she was very close to my heart. So it's kind of, you know, there are no mistakes, but coming here to a young people's event, you know, is just amazing to me, and I feel honored that Ez asked me to speak here. A little bit about me. My life's pretty much been one of those of going through hell from the start. You know, I have gone through a lot of things pre-recovery, and then I've gone through a lot of things post-recovery. I haven't had an easy life. I suffered a lot of sexual abuse, and I don't blame my alcoholism on that. It's just a part of my story, and I'm very passionate about it because it helped my disease bloom. You know, I suffer from the age of 2 to the age of 14, and several sexual abusers, you know, my direct family members. So growing up, I never knew who was a safe person. And I constantly was the one that watched, you know, I went to high school and I didn't even fit in with the nerds. It was that bad, you know, I didn't even fit in with any group. I was just one of those shallow little babies watching everybody go by and go, they got the manual to life, and I didn't, and I'm pissed. You know, at 14, I was gang raped and beaten, left for dead, in a tiny little town, which cracks me up when I think about it. That led to my disease really progressing. I didn't bloom until later in life. I was 23 when I started really drinking heavily. And in the span of 3 years, my life went to hell. It was a therapeutic writing instructor for the disabled, which I still do today. We also worked with a girls' school that was for high-risk adolescent girls. They brought the message to me because I saw them being so excited, so proud of their little medallions. And I'm like, that's cool. Is it 5 o'clock yet? You know, it's a hypocrite living a lie. 2006, to make my story kind of brief, when I came in Alcoholics Anonymous, in 2004 I contracted encephalitis, lost the use of the left side of my body, and was bedridden for almost a year. 2005 I got my life a little bit together, then started having seizures, which were non-epileptic seizures, ended me up getting OD'd and air-vacked at the hospital. Had that happen, then 2005, had to have both my eyes, all the muscles detached, reattached. In a short period of time, I lost everything. I was living with a guy, found out he was an escaped convict from the state of Colorado, called it in, he committed suicide. My cat died, my horse died, like everything just happened in short. Boom, it died. And, you know, I lost my job, I lost my place to live, lost everything. And only place I had to go left was Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I came here. And I was desperate enough that I was desperate enough in AA that I was willing to do whatever they told me. And the most blessed words that an old-timer said to me were, are you willing to go to any lengths for your sobriety and your recovery? And I said, I was so scared and petrified, I said the correct thing and then wish I hadn't for a long time. And I said, yes. And any time I start delving away from the program, old-timers would ask me, are you alive? And I'd be like, maybe. I was so scared. They asked me if I was willing to go to any lengths, and they asked me if I was a liar, and that hurt every time I heard it, and I had to remember that I made them a promise that I would. My sobriety date is September 29th, 2006. Coming into sobriety, I lived in this lovely town for a year. I went through, you know, Hillside, which a lot of people know of. Did the 30 days. I stayed. You know, I stayed. My life's been amazing since then. You know, I've had my ups and have my downs. And then this last year came. I mean, I've gone through surgeries and stayed sober. I've gone through a lot of different things and stayed sober. Cancer scares, losing family members. And I remember that saying. Don't drink no matter what. You know. And I remember that I told them I was willing to go to any lengths. And then, you know, in 2007, depression just kind of snuck in the back door, which is all part of our disease. Little sucker snuck in the back door, and I lost my job. So that kind of nicked the depression a little bit, like, and then it was like, okay, you know, not due to me getting fired. It was just a takeover. Family took over the company I was working for and cleared everybody out. So it's like, okay, I can balance this out. I can get through this. There's nothing in the world like living in the same apartment complex as your sponsor, and your sponsor picking up the phone and calling you and asking you, what's wrong with your car, honey? I'm like, what do you mean, what's wrong with my car? Well, it's getting towed. Lost my car. Turns up a fellow person in recovery. Bought it out of impound because I've done a thing called title loans. And let me say that alcoholics and title loans are two things that really shouldn't ever go together. Learned that the hard way. So I lost my apartment, lost my place to live, I lost my vehicle, lost my job, all in a matter of 2 months. And I had to remember several times over and over again, I told them no matter what. And you know, I struggled. If anybody had told me when I first started this journey at 7 years sober, I would be moving into a recovery home and living there for 6 years, I would have told you you're full. I would have said, no way. It was the best 6 months I had. I got to grow. I got to learn about myself. I got to, you know, help others. The girl that I buried today was one of my housemates. And I actually 12-stepped her into her first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she didn't make it. We lived together for 6 months. And then, you know, I grew. I finally, it took, God, you know, I told him I'd go to any lengths, and I had no idea what I was agreeing to at the time. You know, it took following all the regimen of the halfway house and being up at 8 o'clock in the morning, even though I worked a night job that I didn't get off till 12, and then flipping and going to my other job, which was daytime hours, you know, and keeping up with all the commitments that were required of me. I know what that's like. Went through and graduated that program, got a great place to live, didn't get a car till about 2 months ago, so I got to go a year and a half without a vehicle. And humility. Man, I got to learn about humility, asking people for rides. And, you know, somebody pointed out to me that when I did have a vehicle, I was always running people here and there. So I'm glad I built up that good karma because it came back around when I needed it. I have no clue what I've done on time. I have no clue where I am, 5 minutes, 10 minutes. It's just proof in the pudding that we do recover. And I can gratefully say that I'm a recovered alcoholic. And I know that a lot of people cringe at that. It's the old timers. If you're reading the big book, it says it. We have recovered from a hopeless state of mind and body. And luckily, I do feel that I have recovered. I have to watch on a daily basis that I have to watch for my disease and be ever vigilant because that little voice pops in my head about, you know, self-doubt. That's my biggest one. You know, and I just kind of, sobriety's taught me so many things, and one of the biggest things it's taught me is to observe myself. To observe as I'm getting pissed off and my emotions are racing, to just step back from it and watch it. And the more I do that, the more freedom I get. Because I have to remember that my disease does live in my emotions. And it lives in my thoughts. So if I can remember to take a step back and look, then usually I can find freedom in that. I've struggled with about things through all of my sobriety. And, you know, because I was abused under the name of God when I was a kid. So, as you can imagine, walking into this program and being told to give my will and my life to God, I said, I don't think so. God sucks. You know, today that's not the case. And for me today, I realize, and the biggest thing I'm grateful for in Alcoholics Anonymous is I found out that God isn't something out here or up there or over there. It's right here. It's right here. It's not outside of you. I'm so grateful to have walked out of that funeral today to a big group of young people that are doing the deal and that are here and are alive. And it's, you know, the other thing is I'm learning still. This one's a hard one. I'm still learning to not apologize for my emotions. And it's been one hell of a ride. They told me, you know, strap in and you're going for one hell of a ride. I had no idea what they were talking about. And you know what? I wouldn't trade the sadness and the pain for the gratitude that I feel. And yes, I've been through hell in my sobriety. But it's just the life apparently I chose when I came in here. So I just try to sit back and watch life as it unfolds. And that's all I've got.
Thank you. I'm Joan, ex-alcoholic.
Hi, Joan.
And I'm a little nervous. I really wanted to be of service to this event, and I called Heather, one of the coordinators, and I was thinking I'd be like selling tickets or, you know, being a marathon meeting. She said, panel speaker. And I was like, shit. But I was always told that, you know, when you're asked to be of service, the answer is yes. And so I wanted to do that. And then there are two other reasons that I wanted to be of service to this event. And the first one is that my journey through hell started when I was 13. I started using when I was 13, and actually probably the hell started before that. But and I went through treatment when I was 14 and 18 and 21, and then again when I was 40. And the second reason is that I have a 22-year-old daughter who is 5 months sober by the grace of God. After going through her second treatment and several months of intensive outpatient, and in fact today told me she was working with her sponsor on the second step, and I have such gratitude, and particularly in contrast to your experience today. So anyway, one day at a time, I have a lot of hope for her. I never put together more than a week of clean time when I was a kid, so I have tremendous appreciation and admiration for you guys being on the journey. So, and I thought I would just do sort of the what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. The details of my experience are different, but the feelings, the desperation, and the not feeling like you fit anywhere are similar. I was like an overachiever when I was a little kid. That was the only way that I knew how to feel comfortable in my own skin. But I also was really, really oversensitive. I grew up in kind of a shame-based environment, nothing dramatic at all, pretty normal, but very, very oversensitive, so much so that I overdosed or took my first overdose really before I started using when I was 12 years old. Started 7th grade as a straight-A student, and by the end of 8th grade, I had quit school and run away from home. By the time I was out of my teens, I was an IV drug user, and I was a cutter, and I was had eating disorders. And what I remember really most about it was just the darkness, you know, and I could not ingest enough of anything or escape far enough or wide enough you know, for any light to come into my life. I just felt like I was in the dark all the time. I was a blackout drinker. You know, and in retrospect, just the insanity of what that is. I mean, and nobody ever knew I was like that wasted, right? So I would, of course, drink before I would go to the bars and, or go to parties. And, within a very short period of time, I would remember nothing, you know? And you would think you'd wake up the next day and think, oh my God, you know, be terrified of that experience. But I lived that way for years and years and years. So when they talk about this disease being, you know, there being an insanity component, definitely that was my experience. I got pregnant when I was 25, and I went out once and I drank, and so I basically locked myself into my apartment so I wouldn't use. I wound up delivering when I was 6.5 months pregnant. My now almost 25-year-old daughter was 2 pounds when she was born. She was in the hospital for 2 months. When she came home, I went out about a week later. I hadn't been going out at all. I wound up putting my foot through a windshield, and I went in. I woke up the next morning, and I saw her little booties on the floor next to my bed, and I had no recollection of having picked her up the night before. So I decided then not to use. I thought this kid fought her way into the world, and I owed it to her not to use. And so I quit using and drinking, but I did not get into recovery. What I did instead was get married to an alcoholic, and I focused on my daughter, and I focused on his chronic relapse. A lot of depression, and I lived like that for 8 years. I went out twice in 8 years and drank very alcoholically, and lived really just as dysfunctionally almost just as dysfunctionally. I mean, I held a job and things like that, but certainly emotionally, it wasn't much different. And unhappy marriage, 2 kids, I was prescribed painkillers for migraines, and it was a fateful experience for me. Within a short period of time, I was on painkillers 24/7, Vicodin, Percocet, OxyContin. I had a friend who had a nerve disorder, so she had big bottles of methadone. So I stole those. I got into the mail order painkiller club, which is just shocking to me that was ever legal. I don't know if it still is, but really crazy. And what I loved about painkillers was the anonymity of it, right? So I did not drink much. But 24/7, I was on painkillers for 5 years, and no one knew. I mean, I think they knew I was a shell of a person, but they didn't know that I was using drugs. And I managed to be sort of a high-functioning painkiller addict, I suppose, but emotionally I was deteriorating. And as my kids later told me, I was completely emotionally unavailable to them, which was really important for me to hear about. I finally, you know, just didn't want to live like that anymore, and so I had the great idea that I would, when I didn't have my kids for 4 days, I would self-detox. And I thought I would do that by drinking vodka and taking muscle relaxants. I did that, and nearly burned down my house. Didn't have the flue or whatever you call it open on the fireplace, and was found, you know, naked, having lost all control of my faculties. Had, in the midst of a couple of days, been watching Eric Clapton, saw his Crossroads. He has a treatment center in Antigua, and that's a whole other story, but I wound up there for treatment. So this is at 40. And I got out, and, you know, I went to a few meetings, and all I could see was the differences between me and people. I could not see the similarities. I ran across a couple of leftover Vicodin in the house, and I relapsed. You know, it was a godsend that I could not get high. It did not take the edge off. I don't know what the difference was. I kept trying for several weeks, and what happened was I had a friend her husband died from cancer, and I went to visit her, and I had no intention of doing this, but I left her house, and when I was walking out, there was a big bin of drugs that was waiting to be picked up. So I grabbed Demerol, and I had horses at the time. I had not been an IV drug user since I was a kid, and I stopped and got an equine syringe, and had this Demerol, and I could still not get high. So, you know, I was this was the moment of clarity, right? I was not afraid I was going to die. I was afraid I was going to live. That was the big fear for me. And I'd been to a few meetings. I'd seen a woman. I made the decision that I was going to track her down and beg her to help me. And that's what I did. I live in Scottsdale, and I went to the North Scottsdale Fellowship Club, found her, begged her to help me, and she did. And I did every single thing she told me. I called her every single day. I worked the steps. I went to meetings every day, sometimes more than one. You know, every day when I called her, she would ask me, what are you grateful for? And every day I would find something, and I practice that to this day. So that was what happened. What it's like now is, you know, I don't live in that darkness anymore. People talk about a spiritual awakening, and I don't know what that is for everyone else. I know the way, one of the ways it shows up in my life is that most of the time, not all the time, but most of the time I can find a way, or at least I'm willing to look to see the glass as being half full, and that was never my experience before. I was never a half glass full kind of a girl. The other thing is that I have a relationship with a God of my understanding today, which is, you know, the most important thing in my life. When I was a meth addict as a teenager, I used to, after being up for 2 or 3 days, go and sit in the back of churches and just bawl because I could not feel God in my life. I was not raised in a religious home, but I knew I could not feel God, and today I feel God. And I don't feel God every minute of every day, but most of the time I feel God, and I have a practice in the morning. And when I don't feel God in my own life, I look around at all of you and I see God showing up in your lives, which is just as profound, really. And I don't practice this program perfectly, far, far from it. My recovery date is October 13th, 2006. I have done some really basic things all along, which is go to meetings, and I've had a sponsor. I've hung on to the first and 11th steps. Those have been my cornerstones. It's been great in terms of my relationship with God, but I don't recommend it in terms of emotional sobriety. I've just recently come to terms with, you know, you turn your life, you're willing your life over, and then what do? You work 4 through 12. And I didn't know that for a long, long time. So, progress. Perfection. So, I think that's all I have. Thanks.
Hi, everybody. My name's Hal. I'm an alcoholic. I'm also a drug addict. And there's probably a few other things that I am along the way there, but that'll do for now, I suppose. I'm very grateful to be sitting here with you two. It's a cool place for me to be. I got my back against the wall, which is a good thing for me, and I got people on either side of me, which is another good thing for me. And I'm very grateful that I'm sitting here today, and that I'm sober, and that I'm with a group of people whose primary purpose is to stay sober. And I think it was said very early on in here that people are here to reach out and to help other people. And I think for this alcoholic and drug addict, if I don't do that regularly, I'm in trouble. I'm starting to think about me more than I am about anybody else, and that's not a good thing. We have the advantage today of my wife of 22 years to be sitting right here in the front row. And that what that does for you folks is that gives you a better than average chance of getting the truth out of me today. She's lived with me for a long time. And I'm also glad that you're here, because you're hearing this other stuff, which to me is what they're talking about is normal stuff, but to her, she's a normie. She doesn't get all that stuff. So maybe you guys had give her a little insight as to what I'm thinking and doing. That's pretty cool. I haven't had to take a drink of alcohol or do any dope since June the 21st of 1986. And for that, I'm very grateful. She's very grateful. And law enforcement across the state of Arizona is pretty excited about that. And for anyone who's counting, that's 10,297 days without a drink or without any drugs. I have three children, and they're really not children. My oldest is 27 years old, and he hasn't seen his dad take a drink of alcohol or do any dope. My middle son is 20. And neither has he seen his dad take any drugs or do any alcohol. And then the boss, she is 16 and no doubt is the boss. isn't that right? Yeah. So I took my first drink of alcohol as a preteen at 12 years old. And I didn't get drunk in some fancy bar or hotel or anything like that. My best friend and I pooled our allowance together, came up with $2.50, and had his sister buy us a gallon of Spinata wine. I don't know if there's any wine drinkers in here or not, but you're not going to find that on anybody's wine list. I mean, and we drank the whole thing, and then they came home from the date that they were on, and they brought this bottle of old granddad. It's called Sippin' Whiskey, and we drank that, and we smoked a couple of those left-handed cigarettes, and when all that stuff went off 2.5 inches behind my belly button, why, I had a spiritual experience. And that experience was that I got sick, and I remember being in the backyard of that kid's house, and the two of us looking at each other going, you know, and I'm saying, I'll never do this again. And he's nodding his head, and we're both still getting sick, you know. Well, 5 or 6 days went by, and I must have forgot because I was out doing the same thing again, and that just started that cycle. And I grew up in Scottsdale. My dad was a bartender. My mother was a waitress. Very hard-working, blue-collar people, and taught me the rudiments of setting goals and what was right and wrong. And I barely graduated high school. I went to Saguaro High School. I played a little football and decided I was going to be I had decided very early on in my life I was going to be a United States Marine Semper Fi. And I lost track of my senses for a while there, though, and my best friend and I, back in 1974, when I graduated high school, you could join on the buddy plan and go join the Army. And so we were going to join the Army, and it was weird. It turns out that I'm colorblind, and I wasn't able to join the Army at that time. They weren't taking people that were colorblind, and I was standing outside the office, and this Marine recruiter, Staff Sergeant Glenn Falconberry, walks by. And he looked at me, "What's wrong with you?" And I said, "Well, they won't let me join the Army." And he says, "Well, praise God, you know." And he says, "Why not?" And I said, "Because I'm colorblind." He says, "You're not colorblind." Now, he's got my attention at this point in time. And he says, come here. And he takes me down to the intersection of First Avenue and Adams. And he says, "I'm going to show you that you're not colorblind." And I'm standing there with him, and he's all decked out in his dress blues and everything. And he says, "What color is that red light?" Okay, well, it's red. He says, "See, you know," and then let's try it one more time. "What color's the green light?" You know, and he says, "Yeah, come on." We go in and sign the papers, and then we go over to Tom's Tavern, and we're knocking back a few beers. And I'm at 17, and he's whatever age he was, and it was very, very obvious that was where I wanted to be. And we go home because I'm 17 and got to have mom and dad sign, and mom's crying, and dad can't sign it fast enough, getting me out the door, you know. Join the Marines, and I go off and become a legend in my own mind, kind of thing. And come back, and I never featured I had a drinking problem. I never figured there was a problem in my life. I came home on leave one time, and I borrowed somebody's car, and I did, it was right around Christmas time, and I did a bunch of Christmas shopping, and it was on Christmas Eve, and my family had this tradition of meeting at my parents' home on Christmas Eve, and after I bought all those presents, I stopped and had some eggnog, you know, that special eggnog that has the rum and the brandy. And for years I used to tell people, never drink eggnog. But it was the rum and the brandy that was in it, see. And I came home just hammered. Parked the car out in the middle of the street and grabbed all that stuff and came in the house and made a big scene. And it was the first time that anyone in my family had ever seen me that way. It was the first time that they had seen me an alcoholic. And I was truly an alcoholic at that point in time. I was drinking when I wasn't supposed to be and out of control. And I ping-ponged off the hallway and down into that bedroom and passed out and woke up the next morning full of shame and guilt and remorse, just as it says in that book. And, you know, I resolved at that point in time, well, I took a solemn oath, you know, I'm not going to drink again. And for 20 or so days while I was home on leave, I didn't drink again. And I made sure everybody around me knew that I wasn't drinking. You know, I was a real pain in the ass. And went back, finished up, came back home, and started school out at Scottsdale Community College. I was playing football out there and studying business. And they actually wanted me to go to the classes, you know, and read the books and that kind of stuff. And I couldn't figure out what that was all about. And a friend of mine calls me up one night and he says, "What are you doing Friday?" And I said, "Well, I don't know. You tell me. What are we doing on Friday?" He says, "Well, he's a policeman. He's a policeman over in Tempe." And he says, "My boss likes it when people come out and ride with me, and I want you to come out and ride with me." I go, "Oh, okay, all right, this ought to be a good thing, you know." And so I go out there, and I had to fill out this waiver form and that said basically if they kill me that I can't sue them, you know. And I signed it, and then they had to take my driver's license and do a background check, and I passed the background check, and they buzzed me through this door, and I walk into this room, and here's all these big guys with these big guns and big badges, and I was kind of like that, you know. And I sat down with these guys, and their sergeant told them what was going on, and we go out and they check all their guns and shotguns and all that kind of stuff. I get in the car, and here's the thing, you guys. Here's what I took away from that thing. I went out and I spent 8 hours with these guys. And they went out in the community and they told people what to do, and the people did it. And I don't know about anybody else in the room, but I found that extremely attractive. I really like that. I went back on Monday and changed my major into administration of justice, and within a few short months, I became a Scottsdale police officer. And life changed. I was a hard charger, real motivated, and did all the things that they told me to do. And then after about, well, I don't know, I guess it was a year, 2 years, they came to me and they said, "Hey, we got a special job for you." And I'm like, "Yeah, okay, what is it?" And they said, "Well, we want you to become an undercover narcotics detective." "Yeah, what do I got to do?" And he said, "Well," and that's back when I had hair. He said, "Well, we want you to grow your hair long, sit in the bars and drink, and buy dope." And I'm like, "Tell me again, what is it you want me to do?" "We want you to grow your hair long, sit in the bars and drink, and buy." And then here's what they said. Here's the killer, you guys. "We'll train you." "You're going to train me?" "Well, I think I got this. I know how to do this, you know." And sure enough, that was October 17th of 1982. And by January 1st of 1983, I had on the first day that I started, I had never done cocaine. And by January 1st of 1983, I'm doing 7 grams a day. And I can't stop. I go into bars and drink. Now, I was good at what I did. If I found out somebody had dope, well, then they didn't have it anymore. But I had a training issue. There was a little training issue. I couldn't figure out how to get it back to the property room. At least that's the way I saw it. They saw it a little differently later on. I'll tell you how they saw it. But Yeah, and I lived that way for a good year or so. And, you know, it's a character defect that I've got. I don't know about anybody else in the room, but I love dragging somebody up in front of a judge and going, hey, look what they did. You know, that way I don't have to look at me. And my sponsor, I've had a couple of sponsors over my time in AA. One of them died, and the new one doesn't fail to help me understand that it's about me, those steps are pointed at me, about my character defects and what it is about me that got me here, that earned my seat in this room. And but back then it was really easy to drag somebody up in front of a judge, and then, you know, eventually it all caught up with me, and I stopped doing dope. I had this like moment of clarity, and I said, you know, maybe if I don't do so many drugs, this is going to get better. And lo and behold, it did. I got married along the way to a nice girl, not this woman here today, and she just didn't understand me, you know. And so, you know, life was a revolving thing, a revolving door at my house. She went back and forth. And I had a bunch of dope in my house one day, and I decided that I wasn't going to do that anymore, so I flushed it down the toilet, and it wasn't mine, it was somebody else's, and they got mad, and I had to get tough with them. And I stopped drinking. I stopped drinking for 75 days. Well, you know, I used to, it was like a bad Groundhog's Day thing. I used to get up every morning, I'd come to in the afternoon, and I'd pick up that 9mm pistol off the nightstand where I put it the night before, and I'd put it right in my mouth. And because the struggle that was going on between my head and my heart was such that I wanted off this thing. So one of these women here today said the same thing. They're afraid they were going to live. And I don't want to live anymore. I didn't want to live. It just was it's too demanding. It just eats your soul up. And it was hell for me to live in those times. And, so I decided to stop drinking, and I stopped drinking. I was 75 days clean, and the people that I'd worked for came to me and said, you know, we've noticed some changes around you, and we don't like what we're seeing, and we want you to move from this narcotics position back to regular patrol. And so I had to, you know, shave and shower and do all that stuff every day. And you know, but it was like moving a drug addict and alcoholic from one workstation to the next. I took me with me, and it just didn't work. And so I'm driving around in my car on Valentine's Day of 1986, and I get a call of a guy with a gun, and I go there, and another guy's with me, and guy comes at me with the gun, and pointing the gun at me, pulling the trigger. And I shot him and killed him, and he died on the pavement 2 feet in front of me. And I wasn't prepared for that, emotionally. I was prepared tactically. As a Marine and as a police officer, I knew what I needed to do. But emotionally, taking the life of another human being in broad daylight like that was a little different. And 75 days without a drink, and about a year or so without any drugs. And it wasn't long before I was right back. I mean, this thing is patient, and I was right back. And I'll never forget that scene, that bar that I used to drink at. They used to take cups and turn them upside down in front of you. And when people bought you drinks, I hadn't been there for a couple of months, and people were really glad to see me, and, you know, I was on the news and all that stuff. And I drank every one of them drinks. And it wasn't long before I was headed right back. And thankfully, walked into work on Good Friday, 1986, and they arrested me. They arrested me for all the stuff I'd done before. And life looks different on the other side of the booking counter. It looks hopeless. And got a call from a guy in the program. Guy is one of my best friends today, and says, hey, for there are many people that are pointing the finger at you, there's that many more that are praying for you. And I had no idea what that meant. And he took me to my first AA meeting. Bless you. Took me to my first AA meeting, and I go into that meeting, and it's the hangar group at Deer Valley Airport. And I go down there, and there's this dude there named Kendall. And Kendall looks like a refrigerator with a head on it. Kendall. Kendall, big old corn-fed boy from Nebraska, and he says, he puts his arms around me, and he hugs me, and he says, I love you, and I'm glad you're here. Now, that's not what I was looking for, okay? Okay, it was my first AA meeting. Scared the crap out of me. I mean, I sat down there, and there's 12, 13 people at this meeting, and at my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't hear a word they said because I kept looking at that dude, and if he was going to come over and hug on me again, why, he and I were going to have a conversation, and they took all my guns away from me, and I didn't know how to have a conversation without a gun in my hand, you know, and I didn't know what I was going to do, you know, and here's the real deal out of that thing is that those guys, they stood up and they said a prayer, and everybody in the room held hands, and there was only one person in the room that didn't know the words to that prayer, and they knew, and they looked at me and they said, it was okay, dude, it's all right, just come back, don't drink and come back. And I had to go face that judge. And I looked up at that judge on that was a cool deal. We brought in a bunch of people to tell the judge about a bunch of nice stuff about me, and they all did. And then the prosecution brought in a bunch of people and told the truth. See, the judge saw right through all that. See, and he pounds the gavel and he says, 7 years. 7 years. Now, life in a state penitentiary for a former police officer is it's a little rough. I'll tell you two prison stories. One of them, I'm walking on the yard one day, and I see these three guys out in the middle of the yard, and you know, I'm moving and hoping that, I don't get caught, you know, I don't get killed, and I see these three guys out there, and they're all high-fiving, they're having a big party out in the middle of the yard, and I can't figure it out. I can't figure out what is it that they're so happy about. And I got close enough to them to hear that they were grandfather, father, and son. Three generations of one family. And I don't know as fact, because I didn't hang around to find out, but you know what? It was my wife at the time was 4 or 5 months pregnant with my first child, Kevin, and it was burned into my consciousness that if I don't change my behavior, that's what's waiting for me. And I started going to meetings. I started going to meetings while I was in prison. And this is such a cool story. I was sitting there. I went to this meeting. The first meeting I went to, the little bitty guy's prosecutor, his name is Bill. And the first meeting that I'm sitting at, I'm in an orange jumpsuit. I was with a bunch of guys in an orange jumpsuit, and I was in cambrays and a blue shirt. And he stuck his little bony finger at me, and he says, if you like what you've been getting, you just keep doing what you've been doing. And I wanted to get up and kick his ass right there, you know, because I didn't like what I was getting. Do you want to hear something cool? Last Sunday, I never forgot those words. Never. Last Sunday, they asked me to talk at this meeting down in North Phoenix. I hadn't seen Bill in probably 10 years. And I go in there and I sit down and I'm waiting, and he walks through the door. Same guy recognized me, and he gave me the thumbs up. And we had a little talk afterwards. And I called her afterwards. I said, you're not going to believe this, man, but I ran into a guy who had an impact on me when I was young. So I lasted in that place, they said 7 years, and after 3.5 years, they opened up the doors and they let me out. And, I'd love to tell you that it was all rainbows and roses after I got out, and it was all cool, but I walked through a lot of stuff. while I was in, I got sued for that shooting thing, and I went to trial on that deal, and found not guilty, which is a miracle in and of itself. And so I'm out, and I'm trying to figure out what's going to happen. And then Karen decided she wanted to divorce me, and just crushed me. And but I stayed sober. I didn't drink. I went to meetings. I did the things that I was supposed to do. I went to 90 meetings in 90 days after I got out. Actually, that's not true. I went to about 130 meetings in 90 days after I got out. Yeah. And God, I'd love to tell you know what my first job was when I got out. I got this guy had me delivering boxes to hospitals. He didn't tell me for about a month after I met this guy at the North Scottsdale Fellowship Club, and he felt sorry for me, and he gave me a job delivering these boxes to hospitals. And what it was hypodermic syringes. But he didn't tell me for a month what it was, you know. And you know, life just kind of worked out that way. And I stayed sober, and I met Ellen. And I was about 7 years sober when I met her, and we decided that we were going to get married. And we've got two children together. And she has never once ever failed to encourage me to go to meeting. And I love when she comes to meetings with me. She gets to see the world that we live in. And life today is pretty doggone good. I managed to go to school, and I got a bachelor's degree, and then I went and got a master's degree, and I've been working and living, and come to meetings like this and see people like you. And one of the things that stands out in my mind is that when I hit the 20-year mark, she found my address book. And one of the amends that I made was to the judge who sentenced me. The judge who sentenced me, I met him down in the jury room at Maricopa County on exactly 7 years to the day after he sentenced me to 7 years in prison. And we didn't realize it until we started looking at it. And I was able to look him in the eye and look him and tell him that, you know what, I'm sorry for the things that I thought about you. And how do I make it right? And he told me that just keep doing what you're doing. Stay sober. She found my address book. I had his name and phone number in there, so when I hit 20 years, she invited him to our house and didn't tell me. Huh? So I'm standing in my living room, and I look up, and there's Judge Ted Noyes, the judge who sentenced me to prison, standing in my living room with his wife.
With a bunch of people.
There was a lot of other people there, too. And he says, come here. And, you know, I'm thinking he's in my living room. He's telling me to come. He's the judge, so okay. So I went on over. You know, and he says, you know, this is a special day for me, Hal. And I looked at him and I said, you know, he's a former Marine, by the way. And so he looked at me and he says, it's a special day. And I looked at him. I said, well, you know what? It's a great day for me. Why is it so special for you? And he says, I never get to see this. And you know how intuitive he was? He saw, whoosh, my head goes, yeah. And he goes, no, 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 no. To whom much is given, much is required. He says, you better start giving some of this back. And if you don't, I'll find out about it. And it won't go well for you. You know, and I'm like, ooh. So that's part of the reason I'm here today, is to give back. You know, and I got one more thing to tell you, and then I'll shut up. You know, two Tuesdays ago, it rained real bad down in the valley. I don't know if you guys know that or not, but it rained real bad in the valley, and it totally flooded out our house. Came home at 2:30 in the afternoon. My 16-year-old daughter's in tears. You don't know how humbling it is when your 16-year-old's in tears and you want to be, but you can't be because she is. See, and our house is full of muddy, dirty water to 18 inches or so up. And, I told her, I said, look, I got to do something. I got to start sweeping some of this stuff out of here. I'm going to end up the way you are. And I called her and I told her what was going on. She called some friends of ours, some people that we're spiritually connected with. And by 7 p.m. that night, my house had 30-some-odd people in it. People I didn't even know. By 10 o'clock that night, our house was habitable again, barely, kind of. Guys were asking me, they said, do you want a drink? Are you okay? And I'm like, no, I don't want to drink, and I don't want to use drugs, and but I can see where this would go, how people can be discouraged by this. And, you know, here we are back in hell again, you know. But you know what? One of the things I've learned about the life that we live having looked back and see all the things I've told you, it's not my footprints. I'm aware of whose footprints those are, and they're not mine. I am so grateful that those people that were kind enough to reach out to me, and you know, I'd sit in those meetings, those early meetings, and I'd just be madder than hell. I'd just be wanting to, you know, and those people just pat me on the head and say, just come back, don't drink, you know. I think one of the messages that I want to pass along today is that you don't have to sink that low. You don't have to go that low. You don't have to wind up in a prison cell. You can stop this thing right now. And the key is the steps. The key is working those steps. And as hard and as painful as it may be. Today, this morning, I woke up in my own hotel room. I woke up with someone who loved me, and I knew I was coming here. I knew I was coming here this afternoon, and I went through my day, and we just did some goofy stuff, and it was just a fun day. Here we are, and sat in this room here, and here's the thing. I don't know how long I've been talking to you, probably too long, but I haven't had to tell you one lie. I haven't had a lie once since I've been sitting here. And that's a big deal for a guy like me, you know. I don't know how to end this thing other than to tell you that I'm real glad I'm here. I'm glad all of you are here. I'm glad we're all sober today. And I pray God's blessings on all of you. Thank you for letting me share.